Automotive Archive.
Italian people, most of the time that I can remember growing up, all lived down street on Front Street. So I enjoyed growing up as an Italian, and I lived a happy childhood. We used to run all over Front Street up on Promenade Hill. I went to Allen Street School, 4th Street School, and we had a nice neighborhood. And of course, the best part was Promenade Hill. We'd go up there to see the boats. The Hudson River Dayline boats used to go by twice a day until they went out of business. And we used to see all the nice boats on their way to Albany or on their way to New York, and also the tugboats. We used to have a lot of fun watching them. They'd be dragging all kinds of stuff to New York on the flat boat. And we kept ourselves busy and out of trouble. Never had any trouble on Front Street. Matter of fact, they were all afraid of us. They thought we were a tough bunch, but we were not. We had everything we wanted right there on Front Street. On Marketplace, we had our beautiful church. Most of all, we had our schools. All we had to do was walk down the hill. We weren't too far from them. And we lived a good life. My mother made sure she wrapped us up good in the wintertime when we went to school. She'd wrap our heads up in a shawl. Oh my God, you think we were freezing. But maybe in them days we were. In the wintertime, they'd all be down there ice skating. We used to sleigh ride down Front Street Hill. That was a big, long hill. You went way down by the docks. The area down there was great. I loved it. I loved living there. The boats were beautiful. And then we could look across the river. You see Athens, and you see all the homes there. It was beautiful. I think they still have the same thing there. I don't think anything has changed, but I haven't been down there in a long time. And before I die, I plan to go down there and take a good look at everything that I grew up with. We also had a slaughterhouse down there. That was a poor section of the city. We were poor. My mother and father did the best they could. But you know, coming here from the old country, no education, so the only jobs you could get was either working in a factory for the woman and the railroad and the cement plants for the men. That's what we had. My mother stayed home. She had 5 children. My father worked on the railroad out in the cold weather. I remember him coming home from work late in the afternoon, and he was in the winter time, and he was so cold, he sat down in a chair by the stove, and we had to pull his shoes, boots or whatever they had, off. His feet were practically frozen. Well, when I finished school, my parents did not have a lot of money, so we could not further our education. We had to leave school at a certain age when you were liable for it and go to work, and we go to work in a factory. We had, they used to call that the Swansdown factory. It was a big factory down by the Hudson Bay, and it was a very nice place to work. They used to make winter sweaters. And we always found jobs, and we couldn't wait to get paid on a Saturday and run home and bring your mother the pay envelope. Oh, look what I made this week, or look what we did this week. And my mother really appreciated it, because then we got to have a little better things in life. Oh, well, now let me see. We used to work, we made underwear. They'd have these big, long sheets of knit goods, and we used to have to line them up, maybe 12 deep, And then we'd have a man there that had an electric saw, table saw, and he'd have a pattern, and he used to cut them with this electric saw. And that's what I had to do, leave school and go to work in the factory. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed running home with my pay envelope. Ma, here's my envelope. We used to bring the envelope with the money and never even opened it. I had a bad experience one day on North Front Street. I went home to have my lunch, and I ran a little late, and I had to hurry up. So the ice wagon was going down the hill, and I said, oh, I'll jump on the back of it. It was driven by a horse. I jumped in back of where you stood up, and running down Front Street Hill. When they came to South Front Street, where the school was, the wagon kept going, didn't stop. And I thought I was smart. I'd jump off. Well, I jumped off, and let me tell you, I fell flat on my face. I was all bruised up. Right after that, Allen Street School was right there. I went to school, and I'm in the cloakroom washing and cleaning myself up. The teacher heard me, so she came in, and she said, what happened? And I told her, oh. She says, don't ever do that again. You could get hurt. All right. I never did. I would never jump on a wagon again.
When I first moved upstate, I could actually see in Germantown because it was more in the country, and the Aurora Borealis and millions of stars. These are things I didn't even know existed as a kid growing up in New York City. I mean, if you were born and raised in New York City, and you were never out of there, you never actually saw a nighttime sky. And the first time you see it, you want to crap your pants and say, oh, wow, what is that out there? It's scary, oh my God. I'm now 54 years old, and when I moved to Hudson, I was living down in the Second Ward, which is considered one of the worst areas of Hudson. It's where the high rise is, and a lot of folks in Columbia and State Street are low income. I would walk to work at Columbia Memorial Hospital. I worked as a licensed practical nurse, and I used to walk from down on Mill Street up past 2nd and Columbia, where there was three buildings, I believe, that burned down. I started talking to people in the community, and I talked to someone who said, there's someone else who's interested in maybe creating a community garden and cleaning this up, Amy Cox. Without going into a lot of detail, the first year, all we did is we just picked up garbage. The subsequent year was hilarious. We took pallets and we put them up and made a rough fence with it and planted some things. We used to meet every Saturday, and we found out is that people would just let their kids out of the house on Saturday with no parental supervision, and would come and hang out with us, and we did the best we could. Our process of thinking was to really try to keep the community garden to the Second Ward, because we didn't want people from outside to come in and say, okay, we're going to, take this area and fix it up, and that aspect of gentrification to be involved. And we thought long and hard about, involving people just right there in the community. And we're very proud that we took the poorest part of the community and we're working with that. There was a couple named Bubba and Leslie. They were, tough, but they liked growing collard greens. And there was a guy named Albert another guy named Sonny, who was from Jamaica. And of course, some people from Haiti, some of the earliest Bangladeshis involved, was Nazneen and some others. I grew up in New York City. I'm 54 years old, so I grew up, as a little girl in the 60s. Not really knowing where food came from. I had a mother, one parent, who wasn't born in this country, and so she bought some, she was born in the Philippines, and so she bought ideas about the importance of food, because she grew up on a farm, and then she wound up in a Japanese concentration camp, so she had a lot of issues around food. Definitely both my parents, when they sat down and ate, if they ate chicken, they were breaking open the bones and sucking out the marrow, and they relished everything, the gristle and the fat, and it was all great and wonderful, whereas I was picking at things. My ideas of food started forming there, but I grew up just eating the usual junk that American kids grow up eating, pizza, purple colored flavored drinks and things like that. The reason why we wanted organic is not because we wanted to be elitist, but because we didn't want to put a lot of toxins into the environment. Everybody thinks organic is for rich people, but we wanted organic to be for, you know, just everybody. We tested the soil. There was no lead, so the soil actually tested to be really good. There was a Hudson City Development Planning Corporation agency. They needed to get rid of a little bit of money, and that's when we really got things going. We got a chain link fence around the whole of that corner. And then the next thing we got, which is almost, you know, just as unbelievable and wonderful, is this frost-free faucet. The 2 years prior to that, we were hauling, if you grew food in the garden, we were hauling our water in with buckets and cars, and the water would be sloshing on the in your car, and very difficult to grow food that way. Amy and I were talking about the garden as not just being a nice thing for the community or a nice thing to do, but we were talking about food insecurity in the second ward, about people not having enough money for food and how to address that issue. I personally felt this is growing your own food as being a revolutionary act, because, you know, when I had someone walk up to me and say, you know, why am I spending so much money to buy a tomato in a supermarket that tastes like cardboard, then I thought, well, what the hell? Why are we so plugged into having to rely on a corporation to provide food for us? Why can't we just grow our own? And that could even lead into a spiritual component, but I'll leave that up to whoever's listening to this to figure out. My family was always kind of in, my mother had schizophrenia. I had brothers and sisters, or brother and sisters who didn't grow up, some of them didn't grow up at home, were given up for adoption because parents had a hard time taking care of their kids. And then my brother and I spent a lot of time in and out of foster homes. My father, he wound up going to jail for first degree manslaughter. And at the time, I had been hanging out with a guy that I met who actually was from upstate New York. And when my father went to jail and my mother wound up going back in the mental hospital and actually never came back out, I was 18 and my brother was about 13. And this friend said, let's just, you know, move upstate. It was a very tough time in the city. It was the late 70s, tremendously violent. And I said, yeah, let's get the hell out of here, because I didn't know where else to go and I didn't have any other family. And then we moved upstate to Germantown and lived there with my friend's mother for quite a few years. My father got out of jail and he died, and he left a little bit of money, believe it or not. I bought a small house in Hudson in the second ward. At that time, the house was kind of expensive. It was $45,000, and that's why I was in Hudson. I think that the species is really, really flawed and unconscious, and I really include myself in that. And I think, you know, just my own struggle for consciousness and awareness has been long and difficult, and I still think there's a lot to learn. And I also think that there's a lot of very reptilian qualities in all of us that we don't really want to admit to. I don't know if there's anything to do. There's a Pablo Neruda poem. It's like maybe things not to do, to stop doing. And understand the seriousness of it, you know, that the way I live every day, you know, truly has an effect on everything else in a very deep way. And it has a tremendous effect on yourself. People caring about each other, you can't institute that. But you can create a culture over time where that can happen. And so we have to embrace every bit of our community, every part of it.
So when I came up here, I kept waiting. I said, Mother, when are we going down south? Mother, when am I going home? Because I didn't realize we were a long ways away, although we took a train. And she said, Honey, you are home. I said, no, I'm not home. I've got to go home. There was this hill, and I used to look over the hill and think that was Virginia. It was really Athens. And one time I took the ferry, trying to find Virginia, trying to find home. And it wasn't home, and I came back, and I sort of put it aside. I just lived in that world that was my own. I was born in Clover, Virginia. I came up here when I was 6. My grandfather was a preacher and a farmer, and we are from an educational family going back hundreds of years, when people, black people, were sharecroppers, not even going to school. My aunts and uncles had their masters. I guess it's ingrained in me, the need for an education. At the time I was going to school, Hudson was rated one of the best schools in New York State. And if you graduated from Hudson High, you can go to any college in the country, Harvard, Yale, anywhere. It was a top-rated school. And at that time, there were only seven, when I was in high school, there were seven black children, 769 children, but seven black. I always remembered that number. I loved being in school. I loved learning. But I always had this, there was always a cultural difference, though, because I was a dreamer and I used to play in the woods. I don't know who I'd be playing with because I was by myself, but little sparkly creatures and everything that my mind created. And when I say daydream, I used to be in such a trance. I didn't hear anything, didn't know anything, because I was in my own world. I was just free, and I loved that freedom. And when I didn't daydream, I was very smart. When I daydreamed, I was dumb. You know anything. I failed kindergarten, if that's possible. So sometimes I feel, you know, because I didn't know which way I was going to go. But if you want to connect with children, you have to come down to their level and see things through their eyes.
The more we get together, the happier we'll be. For your friends are my friends, and my friends are your friends.
The Village School, well, it ran from 97 to 99. No, it ran from, 3 years. 3 years it ran. And then 99, we start working on the charter school application. In the meantime, we were put out of two different places. I mean, the places were really nice, but people didn't want to look at black kids on Warren Street. And we had that great big building with the pillars on Warren Street. Beautiful big building. Well, you saw it. The picture is here. You see the picture here of the... That's it. But there's also, oh, here. We had this, there's a yellow building, and this is the living room. This is Joette leading the choir. Those kids sang beautifully. We had a choir, and anyway, and this was the little building that I had as sort of a nursery. Yeah, and this is the living room. It was beautiful. And I was there for nearly 10 years. It was 23 rooms. So we had room for an emergency shelter and everything else we needed. And I had 32 children. I started with 12, and I had ended with 32. We had white and black children, but it was predominantly black. And when they came in the morning, they were there at 7. They're not supposed to be there at 7. And they would holler from the window for me to get up and let them in, you know. And they didn't, but they did that everywhere I was, the kids, because they think they own me, you know. I was an extension of them. Yeah. So anyway, they were there from 7. They would come in, and first thing they did was eat. I mean, it was, everything was theirs. Everything belonged to them. They went in the refrigerator, and the people would say, "Why do you let them go in the refrigerator?" I said, "Because it's theirs." And social service sent me over a lot of volunteers to do cleanup and stuff. And we got food from the food pantry, the Latham food pantry. So there was plenty of food. So it didn't cost much money to run the school. And sometimes people were upset because the kids belonged to the place and the place belonged to the children. So if you want a program to work, you have to give them ownership. And they were so proud of themselves. And I was proud of them. They were learning. And you can tell they were learning. You can see it in their expression, their face, in their eyes. And it was really remarkable. School got out at 3:30. And the kids, usually by 5, all the kids had left. But you had to make them leave. They didn't want to leave. You had to make them leave. A lot of the children in that village school are now professionals. They're LPNs, getting ready to work on their RNs. They are caseworkers. They are teachers. My dream was that the community would be empowered, that people who are powerless, black and white, would become powerful, would be put in touch with that inner spirit inside of them that can overcome mountains. If you make a child or a person feel good about themselves, there is no stopping them. They can accomplish anything, any child.
I'm closer to the end now than I am the beginning. So I try to enjoy myself as much as possible. Other than that, there's so much in my life that it's hard to explain a lot of it. Had six children. Four of them are still living. I lost two. I got 10 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren. And I tease them a lot. I tell them I don't know who they are. They got to wear stickers because I can't remember their names. I love them all. They're good. I got a good family, all hard-working, good providers. Of course, after my working in the mill and my dad passed away, I've been a bar owner since 1969, and it's been a good life. Met a lot of good people. You got to have something to dream about. If not, it's a loss. You're a lost cause. And keeps you young. My dad had bought a bar, and I went back to my old job, plus working for him evenings. And I'd done that until 1969, when he passed away. And I've been here at this location ever since. Took care of my mother and family. And the rest of my life is more or less here in the bar room. When there was a lot of industry here in town, the cement companies and ginger ale plant, they worked three shifts. And I used to open up 8 o'clock in the morning, and the bar would be full by 7:45 until about 10 o'clock. That was the midnight shift coming off. 3 o'clock in the afternoon when the day shift come off, they'd be here about 3:15, stay 2-3 hours. And then there was a midnight shift. And I've been running alone for 41 years. And I used to open 8 o'clock in the morning and close 2:30 in the morning, 6 days a week. And for my first 5 months, the only time I left this building was to go down because I cashed checks for the working people out of the cement company. And I would go down once a week, down to the bank, to recash them. But I started on a shoestring, so I was kind of afraid to leave the building. So for 5 months, I walked from here down to the Farmers Bank in them days. Hudson was a great place when I was a kid. All the stores up and down the streets. Of course, naturally, there was two ice cream parlors. Yeah. That sometimes my music teacher wouldn't be feeling too good. So he'd tell me, he said, don't tell your parents, but you don't have to take a lesson today. Then I'd go to the movies. The movies was the Star Theater, all Westerns. And I had cartoons, the news, and always had a cereal. 12 cents. After the movies, there was an ice cream parlor down on a corner of a second. The name of it was Fatty Fiola's. And homemade ice cream they made. The treat was a banana split, 25 cents. Three big scoops of ice cream with all the toppings and a whole banana, not sliced, a whole banana. Boy, couldn't wait for that. About every third week, that was the treat for days you put in working. And I got all beautiful customers here. I don't put up with no nonsense. And anybody that stops here, I'm very fortunate because they fall in love with the place and they come back. In the last few years, I've had three movie productions shot here. Ironweed, Jack Nicholson and Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep is a wonderful woman. And I had Nobody's Fool. There's nobody that could even come close to Paul Newman. He's such a great guy. Oh, the original name of this place was the Steak Grill. And the gentleman that opened it after Prohibition, or just before Prohibition, he opened this. He went up to Albany to buy glasses and chairs, and he just seen this neon sign laying there. It said Steak Grill. So he bought it and just hung it up. But when Nobody's Fool production came here, according to the book, the story, the bar that Mr. Newman frequently went to was the Iron Horse. So they took my sign down, built this sign, the Iron Horse, and everybody liked it because of the railroad tracks that runs by here with the train. So when they got ready to leave, it was 10 below zero outside. And the guys are setting up the ladder, and I said, by the way, fellas, I said, is there any chance I can buy that sign? He said, you want it? I said, yeah. He said, it's yours. He said, you just saved our life. Said, man, it's cold out there. So that's how I got the sign from the movie, Nobody's Fool. And, of course, I left it there. It's a different era. I was selling beer, a glass of beer, for 15 cents. And now I sell it for a dollar, and I'm still cheap. So, but I don't really need anything anymore for myself. I'm satisfied with life.
So I was fortunate to go to a very good college, but I was always sort of very restless, even in those early years in college, and I really wanted somehow to break free of it. So after 2 years of college, I decided to switch to the University of Detroit in Detroit, Michigan, and I also sought full-time employment for the first time in my life. And I started working for a division of General Motors and also exploring and trying to learn about who I was. And one of the things I discovered about myself was that I was a gay man. My name is Harold Hansen. I'm now 73 years old. I've lived in this area you could call it the Upper Hudson Valley, since 1986. I came here from New York City, although I was born in Pontiac, Michigan. I went to New York City when I was 21 and began a career, a varied career in New York City, starting at the age of 21 until the age of 45 when I came to Hudson. There was another aspect of my life at that time I want to talk about. Since I was 16 or 17 years old, I'd been very interested in the issue of Black America. In fact, the first roommate I had in Detroit was in the first police cadet corps. The very first time the Detroit police force sought out to have Black police members. So one of their cadets was my first roommate. And by coincidence, he was also gay. I've actually worked very hard in a lot of different professions, a lot of different occupations. I think it's curiosity about life that has motivated me the most. Came to New York, worked in Wall Street, segued into investment counseling and investment management, then investment publishing, then artist management, then opening an antique shop. Maintaining a shop on the Upper East Side of Manhattan was financially very expensive. So I returned to Brooklyn Heights. And there I met a woman, friend, who had just bought a historic home in the city of Hudson, which I had never heard of until I met her. So I stayed one weekend, came back a second weekend, and perhaps 1 month thereafter, I decided to close my store in Manhattan and relocate to Hudson. At that time, there were only four antique shops in Hudson. This was 1987. So when I arrived in Hudson, I set up a shop right next door to the Hudson Register Star, which is our community newspaper. I also became familiar with some of the people that were beginning to acquire investment properties in Hudson. So in the short span of a year and a half, I opened a shop in Hudson. I also became the largest property manager in the city of Hudson. And one of the realities of Hudson back in the mid-80s was that the city was very separated between Blacks and whites. And that was something that caused me concern at the time. Even as far as where people could rent apartments was an issue. So I began to employ Blacks among the people I employed to renovate buildings, but I also began to rent apartments to people in buildings that were previously white only. But also in the course of doing all that, one of the people that I interviewed was a young man by the name of Larry, who was just a recent arrival from Florida. And he had come to Hudson because he had heard how well people could do picking fruit in season in Columbia County, which was true back in the 80s. When I lived in New York City from the ages of 21 to 45, although I met people and liked people and had relationships with people, I couldn't really say there was anyone I ever loved. But I did find someone that I loved when I met Larry at the age of 45 in Hudson, New York. And in his own fashion and in his own way, he reciprocated. As unlikely as it may sound, at that time he was only 18 years old, although he had told me that he was 20. He was in fact 18 years of age. In recent years, as an indication of just of age, I've suffered different medical difficulties, but Larry's always been there for me to assist me and help me sustain the store and sustain a good life at my home in Catskill. Every 5 or 6 years, people rediscover Hudson. With every new generation of arrivals, people feel like they've discovered a unique city, but not realizing that that whole process had been gone through 5 and 6 times before by other people. But Hudson is also marked by the same characteristic that I found way back in the mid-80s. And there is still a disharmony, or there's a gap between the whites and blacks that persists even now in the year 2013. Throughout my entire life, I have seen many manifestations of inequity between whites and blacks and between whites and other races. I mean, I have felt it. I also feel that issue extends to Latin Americans, to women. I see it almost daily in my life, even if it's nothing but just something very subtle and passing. I feel that we've lived in a land of restricted privilege, principally for white men, of which I'm one of. I wake up every morning with great optimism. I do take medicine in the morning. That does sustain me through the day. I believe in opening my shop at 11 o'clock every day, at least 6 days a week. I try to have a basic personality that I offer people. I try to be consistent in how I interact with people. I try to be courteous. I try to be helpful. I try not to take advantage of people. And I aspire to be as helpful to others as I'm capable of being every day of my life.
You do not die when your story is not ending. Immortality has taken place. And you do not die when your name is spoken. Elombe Badila will be spoken. And you can never perish if you are in the hearts and minds and souls of those who love you. And he will remain there. Eternally. I am co-founder with my husband, Andre Badila, of Diata Diata International Folkloric Theater, which is a family-based production company celebrating ancestral heritage and everyday adventures in life. Over the 30 years that we've been together, we have learned that faith, not in religion, although we celebrate, as my husband calls it, Nzambi Mpungu, we believe in nature. We believe in the forces of nature, that which exists between the sky and the earth and the waters and all the elements of nature. We find God in that. As I sit at this table and look across into your face, I see God in that. We learn to understand the reciprocity where we give appreciation for our life passage, and which time nature also gives us appreciation for enduring that path. July 10th, he passed onto the realm of his ancestors and no longer is physically here with us. In fact, I expected this to be a very, very difficult time to talk. And in fact, it's a releasing moment to talk because we have so great a realm of experience together. I can draw from 30 years of memories. What a wonderful life we've led together. And he has been able to do everything he's wanted to do in the 64 years on this planet. And already I feel his presence everywhere I go, which is a comforting presence. It's also a release of some of the deep and heavy sadness that I was feeling. And I'm sure there'll be moments, but unless somebody comes up to me with their sad faces and hugs and I'm your loss, I don't feel a loss except the physicality that I can't feel his beautiful hands or, you know, touch his face. But, you know, communication is something that comes from feeling within, an expression of a moment of emotion, any feeling that you're able to successfully transmit to another. And that is not so difficult. Sometimes with words, it's more difficult. You stumble over things that you want to say that don't express how deeply you feel. And so sometimes it's better to smile at someone and say nothing, or to take their hand and say nothing, hug them, say nothing. Or just as he would do for 45 years, paint an original image that shares a moment in time that celebrates being in a place within that moment in time. Over the years, 45 years, the last day he did that was out on the street of Hudson in front of Nolita, our favorite cafe, because the people are so wonderful there, on Father's Day, June 17th of this year, and celebrating giving. Every time he paints, somebody comes up, he'll talk to them for a moment, and just because they shared that moment with him, he felt so inclined and full of generosity, he would offer. And people felt sometimes embarrassed. They didn't want to accept it. They said, no, let me just give you something. We'd always say, well, if you want to buy one, you can buy another one. But this that I'm giving you is a gift, and a gift does not have a price. This time, we celebrate light that he brought to the world, at the same time the sun setting on his mortality. But my sister, Roxanne, who we lived with for a few months before we got our own house, she suggested a parade. I said, okay. So we went to see the mayor, and we asked him, could we have a, you know, gathering permit and all that, and have a parade down Warren Street, and proceeded, because we always, people know us to walk to the sunset and celebrate our prayers in front of the sunset often, in all seasons. And he said, okay. The kids did all the promotion. My friend loaned us her truck and trailer. Another friend loaned us a generator, or her generator. Another one, sound system, so people could make reflections if they wanted to. And then we just invited people to join us and wear bright colors. That's it. And on the moment, we went to the funeral home. We were there the night before, 12 hours painting that sarcophage, which was it looked like a crematorium box. It was like practically cardboard. It looked like, as they said, it's wood-covered, a cloth-covered wood. But, you know, you see staples holding cardboard parts together. It was not a fancy coffin. It ended up being the most beautiful thing. 12 hours. We didn't cry for one moment of it, just painting and making reflections and having fellowship among those who were most intimate with Badila. We were painting scenes of endearment. Everything that we knew he would like, we painted all over it. And then the parade was everybody walking down to the river, like we always walked to the river to celebrate the sun. This time, we celebrate light that he brought to the world, at the same time the sun setting on his mortality. And as I spoke to the people, I told them, and I didn't think I was going to be able to talk. All the days before, screaming and crying, I didn't think, but my voice came back to me to tell them who he was. Because we carried him up to the sunset where we actually stand together. And I was screaming out his names and the names of all the kids that he's the father of. And who he is, that his name never stopped being spoken, that he'd never be forgotten, that his legacy live eternally, that he is the invincible, even over death he has triumphed because he is immortal, that he is beloved, and that we will now rejoice knowing that the sun will set on another day, this time in another adventure of this not-ever-to-end story. And then we must understand that and let him go, and not try to hold on by sorrow, but to release him with joy.
It's fare thee well, my darling true, I'm leaving in the hours of the morn. I'm bound for the Bay of Mexico, or maybe the coast of California. It's farewell, my own true love, we'll meet again another day, another time. It's not the leaving that's a grieving me, but my darling who's bound to stay behind. I'll write you a letter from time to time. While I ramble, you can travel with me too. With my head and my heart and my hands, my love, I'll write what I know back home to you. It's farewell, my own true love. We'll meet again another day, another time. It's not the leaving that's a grieving me, but
but my darling is bound to stay behind. I'll write you of troubles and of laughter, be they somebody else's or my own. With my hands in my pocket and my coat collar high, I'll travel unnoticed and unknown. It's farewell, my own true love, we'll meet again another day, another time. It's not the leaving that's a grieving me, but my darling who's bound to stay behind.
This is the end of Automotive Archive.
Sometime I ply the old gray man, then I ply the cutie. When I make my 50 cents, Lord, I carry it home to Rosie. Come on, hell, mule. Lordy, Lord. I about to stole my old coon dog, boy, the wish to bring him back. He run down Big Arm's old defense, boy, and the little arm through the crack. Hee-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo, hoo oh, Lordy, Lord. Hee-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo- I've been rolling, 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 rolling. But we gonna make that money, Lord, we gonna carry it home to Rosie. Ooh, Lordy, Lord. Black gal wear the broken shoe, the yellow gal wear the slipper. I don't care what old Flat say, we gonna ride in a Lincoln zipper. Hey, come on here, boy. Oh, Lordy, Lord. Hey, 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 hey. Well, we gonna get drunk Saturday night. Let's save up a little change. Ooh, 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 ooh. Yeah, yeah, Lordy, Lord. Ask that gal to marry me, boys. What do you reckon she said? CB, I would not have you if all the rest was dead. Boys, you know that I'm in bad shape tonight. I'm telling you, me and that gal sure gonna have a fight. Hey, 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 what's the matter, John? I don't know, Bill. You got any chaw in the back over there? No, boy, I got some of the best old rolls you ever tangled in your teeth. Come up over there, old Blue. Staggle back there, broad. Boy, I'm having a tough time with this, I'm telling you. Maybe I'll make this load all right. You know, Flat Top got to get a little gin then. Then we go on down in Kingston's Bottom. Down there and get us a few of them hamburgers, you know. Oh, Lord. Well, hey, hey, hey. Oh, Lordy, Lordy, Lord. I'ma keep on talking. I ain't gonna sing no more. When this is over, boys, I'm gonna let it go. Ooh, oh, oh, Lordy, Lord.
each step is moving, it's moving me up. Moving, it's moving me up. Every step is moving me up.
Step is moving, it's moving me. Moving, it's moving me up. Every step moving me up.
I'm so far.
There is moving me up. Moving, it's moving me up. Every step is moving me up.
Bitter searching of the heart, quickened with passion and with pain, we rise to play a greater part. This is the faith from which we start. Men shall know commonwealth again from bitter searching of the heart. We love the easy and the smart, but now with keener hand and brain, we rise to play a greater part. The lesser loyalties depart, and neither race nor creed remain from bitter searching of the heart. not steering by the venal chart that tricked the mass for private gain. We rise to play a greater part, reshaping narrow law and art, whose symbols are the millions slain. From bitter searching of the heart, we rise to play a greater part. This is the faith from which we start. Men shall know commonwealth again. From bitter searching of the heart, we rise to play a greater part. The lesser loyalties depart, and neither race nor creed remain. From bitter searching of the heart, we rise to play a greater part. Reshaping narrow law and art, whose symbols are the millions slain. From bitter searching of the heart, we rise to play a greater part. This is the faith from which we start. Men shall know commonwealth again. Bitter searching of the heart, we rise to play a greater part. This is the faith from which we start. Men shall know commonwealth again. From bitter searching of the heart, we rise to play a greater part. Not steering by the venal chart that tricked the mass private gain. We rise to play a greater part. Reshaping narrow law and art, whose symbols are the millions slain. Bitter searching of the heart, we rise to play a greater part.